Hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast.
If you like this podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you take just a few minutes and leave a review for me on iTunes. It is super easy to do, and it makes the podcast easier for other people to find. Plus, it helps me get so many of these great guests that you hear on the show. So all you need to do is go to savvypainter.com/review. That page has a direct link to iTunes where you can leave your review. It would mean so much to me, and I thank you in advance for that. The Savvy Painter Podcast is published every week on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, iHeartRadio, and SoundCloud. If you are a painter or artist who is looking for down-to-earth, real-life conversations about art, how to create it, how to sell it, you are in the right place. Savvy Painter has been downloaded over a million times by artists in 150 countries. This is the place where you will find your community, you will be inspired to create, and you'll hear real stories from artists who are thriving with their art. So if you are new to this podcast, I want to welcome you to the Savvy Painter community. But make sure you don't miss an episode. Sign up for weekly updates, free guides, and workshop announcements. Go to savvypainter.com and click on join. It's that easy. Now let's get started. A few weeks ago, you might remember I shared a conversation with Lonnie Irwin, and I mentioned that I had also spoken to her husband, Alan Veltis. Well, this week, it is my great honor and privilege to share that conversation with you. Alan Veltis received his BFA from Cooper Union and his MFA from Yale. He has received numerous awards, including the Paulette Krasner Foundation Grant in Painting, the Raymond Nielsen Prize, and the Rome Prize Fellowship. And the 2 years that he spent in the self-study program in Italy turned out to be pivotal for him. Alan had an incredible exposure to the arts as a child, in part because of a friendship with his neighbor, the Hungarian artist Shari Neen. And in this episode, Alan shares stories of his childhood and his early exposure to an incredible array of artists. Alan and I talk about his painting process, how he uses photographs to spark an idea and then uses a series of mirrors with himself as the model for reference for his figurative work. He starts by making marks and adjusting. Alan has a vague idea of the painting depending on the shape and the size of the canvas, but he's an intuitive painter. He takes his time deciding how to approach his subject, and his works have endless possible readings. Alan also gives advice to young painters, and we talk about experimenting with your art and leaving time for transitions to occur. He talks about playfulness and also making the extra effort to go to museums and to see art in person, even if you have to spend extra effort and even extra money to do so. He highly recommends it and tells you why. So take notes while you listen to this interview. Listen closely. Alan shares many jewels during this talk. So here is Alan Veltis. Alan, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast. I am honored and privileged to be able to have this conversation with you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, to be able to do this.
I'm curious, as a child, you had an incredible exposure to the arts, in part because, if I understand correctly, your mother rented an apartment from a Hungarian artist, Shari Neen, if I'm saying her name correctly.
My mother knew a lot of artists. She lived in New York. She was not an artist herself, but a lot of her closest friends were artists. And that made a difference. Shari Neen was the one who was most important to me. I spent most time with her and most time in her studio. And that was partly by chance, but she was the one I got to know best. Mm-hmm. And she is also barely known. There is a website that was put up after she died. She was born in 1898 or 99, I'm not sure. So I got to know her when she was in her 50s.
And you were sort of like a studio assistant to her, is that correct?
Well, as a kid, more or less, my brother and I did various things for her, but I was more interested than my brother was. Yeah, Peter and I helped her to build racks in her studio, and that Shari moved to the country, to a place, New York State, not too far from the city, but up the Hudson a bit. It was an interesting place where somebody funded it, personal money bought a piece of land and built for the first resident artist there. He built houses for them according to their wishes. And there were just a few, I don't know how many, can't remember, maybe six or eight. But in the beginning, before she was there, John Cage and Merce Cunningham were there. They were good friends of Shari's. She knew a lot of people like that. She knew them well.
Wow.
There was a potter named M.C. Richards. I think Stan Vanderbeek might have been there, but I didn't know him.
Uh-huh.
He made video films. He was the big name in videos at the time. But Shari had a concrete block cube, kind of a cube in terms of dimensions. And then the smaller part of it had a kitchen below a bedroom. The rest of it was a double high ceiling with lots of light.
Beautiful.
For her to work in, surrounded by, on the backside by woods.
Sounds like a dream.
She was Hungarian. She moved to the States, I think, just when beginning of the war, World War II, and couldn't move back because of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So she settled in New York. But her own work was found objects, reworked, made into things. The drawings and paintings that were more traditional that she had done were before I knew her, when she was young. But she was a fascinating person. She had a very special way of seeing the world and seeing the beauty in everything and the potential in anything picked up off the street or found in the woods.
What were some of your most memorable experiences with her? Just out of curiosity, because it seems like you were exposed to so many, especially at that age, like that just sounds to me like if you're interested in art, and maybe this is with the, hindsight of being 2020 at the time, maybe.
Well, it was important to me then because I really loved being in her studio and being around her. And I couldn't think of a different kind of profession for myself. But with Shari, well, there were times when she was making what she called rubbings. My brother and I would go out with her. We didn't do this very often. I can only remember two or three times maybe. But I do remember doing it, that we would carry her glass palette and her inks and her rollers. She had the kind of soft rollers for rolling ink out on a palette, on a piece of glass. And then the paper would be laid on top of manhole covers and that sort of thing in the streets. And then with a roller, she'd go across them with ink, and it would pick up what was raised. So the manhole covers, the written part and the patterns that were raised would get inked, and the parts that were recessed in the lower parts would stay white, the white of the paper.
Mm-hmm.
But she would overlap them and play with them in terms of positioning. And another place, there was a place that the son had made the tar. I think it was, I think it might have been in Central Park, but near the edge, near the southern edge of Central Park. The sidewalk was paved, but the paving had wrinkled, and she thought of it as elephant skin, the kind of surface of an elephant's body, so she could roll her rollers on this paper over something like that. We would go out in the morning when there was no traffic, like at 3 a.m. or something, or 4 a.m. We just wake up and, because we lived just upstairs from her, 2 or 3 floors, and we'd arrange to do this, to go out when there are no cars around. In terms of what might have influenced me, aside from the life of the artist, which was important, I was fascinated by artist studios, and hers was the one that I really spent a lot of time while she was doing whatever she was doing. And there was a shoe store, Salamander Shoes, that were imported, and they would be imported by ship in wooden crates, and the crates would be put out for the trucks, the trash collection.
Uh-huh.
And Peter and I would take these crates that were probably, I don't know, I mean, they were bigger than something like a washing machine. And we stacked these because her studio had space enough to make a whole wall of these crates, these wooden crates. And then she could organize things like portfolios of drawings and old paintings and things that she found on the streets, and like a lifetime of work, basically. But just being with her was the kind of unconscious learning process of being with somebody who saw everything in a very innocent, open-minded way. She would pick up something or look at something and really see it for what it is and have a sense of how to combine it, because she knew a lot about the history of art, the Dada period, and Duchamp with his ready-mades and Cornell's boxes. I'm sure she knew them. They may not have been well-known, but they must have been shows. And Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, Bob Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns were friends. They would sometimes, and this was early in their lives, in their careers, they would sometimes be at her studio. I didn't know them well, but I'd seen them around now and then. But when Rauschenberg had that exhibition that had there's a piece, I can't remember the title of that one offhand, but it had an eagle, a stuffed eagle, fairly large, protruding from it with the wings outspread and a pillow hanging under it, under that, hanging from the painting, an actual pillow with a rope around it. And the rest of it was paint and maybe collage, but, you know, abstract.
Yes. Do you remember what you were thinking when you were seeing these?
It interested me. And I did a lot of stuff with collage that must have been mostly graduate school period that I was using collage, but differently from Rauschenberg and those people. But I was going to say that eagle that's on that painting, part of that painting, I had seen that in the doorway of the studio next to Shari's. These were studios that we lived in. But the studio next to Shari's, when the door was open, there was a wall of like the backside of a bookcase or something that was maybe 7 feet high. And on top of that was this eagle, very blackish gray dust, you know, covered in, I assume, in years of dust.
Right.
And it was there all the years that we lived in the building. Whenever that door was open, I couldn't see around behind that wall, the back of that piece of furniture, but I could see that eagle. And I was pretty sure that seeing that Rauschenberg, that was that eagle. And then I came across something that said that, oh, it might have been on Shari's website even, that said that she gave Rauschenberg that eagle. So I imagine when that building was vacated to be replaced by something much bigger, as all of Manhattan is doing right now. But this was early to mid 60s when they tore the building down. I imagine he just left things, abandoned things, and she took that eagle. So it's the very eagle that I had known before he had seen it, I guess.
Wow. And do you think that's the same eagle that's in the piece? He used it in the piece?
Yeah, it is, because I thought it was from the look of it. And then I think I read on Shari's website, whoever was writing on that, because I think it was created after she died. But this young man who shared what they called the Crooked House on Spring Street in Manhattan, Spring Street over near which is the West Village, over near the Hudson River, there was a little crooked house, literally crooked. The ground shifted under it, and it was crooked enough that you could almost lose your balance walking up the steps. a narrow, small house. And Richard Heyman, who was a young composer, somehow Shari got to know him, and he bought the house, and she helped. She paid some part so that she could have a room for when she was in Manhattan, in the city, instead of in her country place. After she died, I think Richard organized, you know, got some help to pay for it and organized a recreation of her studio, not too far, I think, from where her studio was, but somewhere else a little bit upstate from the city.
Wow.
And I think because it really was a kind of an amazing place, and she never had extra money. She was never successful in terms of selling her work.
Mm.
but it didn't stop her from making and living the life of an artist in a wonderful way. And she had a lot of friends and people who visit her out at her country place also. So he did the website, I believe, or organized it, and the recreation of the studio.
Ah, okay.
See, the story with that land, what they called the land, I think, with those studios, the artist or the person it was made for could keep it as long as that person wanted to. She kept it until she died. Shari did. And then somebody else has been in it, and probably it's changed hands a few times. I just don't know. I haven't been back. You know, I'm not in the States to wander and look.
Yeah.
But it's made to her specifications. It had some of the things she did personally. For example, there was a little space, it might have been 7 foot square in the floor of the studio that was recessed, that went down lower with a kind of fireplace that you could sit around that. And the fireplace, maybe an iron sort of fireplace, it was in the middle, but at eye level. The fire would be at eye level and you could have your legs hanging over the side.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And there was a lot to learn from just being with somebody who is that intuitive.
Yeah. And I'm curious, I mean, it's so, because you said your mother was not an artist. So Shari, it sounds like, really is the person who sort of ignited the fire, I guess you'd say, for you to be an artist, and also kind of, it sounds to me at least, like allowed you to either participate in or observe just that creative freedom and what I love is that natural childlike curiosity that is such a big part of being an artist and that we all hope we never lose.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, starting at a much earlier age, I had been going to museums because my mother would do that. And gallery openings she would go to because she knew artists.
At what point did you decide you wanted to study art and really, because you said like you really were attracted to this lifestyle and your brother, Peter, on the other hand, wasn't?
Mostly it was not feeling that I could do anything other than work with my hands or be happy doing it.
Yeah.
I never, as a kid, I never took music lessons or the kind of thing that, like, to be a musician or a composer, probably you start early and you work at it. And my exposure, early exposure, was art museums and artist studios, mm-hmm. and living in the city. But I couldn't see myself, I didn't have the kind of mind and temperament to study to be a lawyer or a scholar, a research person or something. Probably I was a little dyslexic, not severely dyslexic, but a little, like I think a lot of us were, a lot of artists probably.
Yeah. And at that time, probably nobody would have noticed it or been able to help.
Yeah. I think it wasn't recognized. I don't think there was a name for it yet. We were just bad kids. Kids who wouldn't pay attention. I would look out the window and daydream and hope not to be called on by the teacher for years. The early years were like, and there were some kids who were just terrific at studying and did really well. But also because in the period when my parents separated, I lost a grade of school that would have been, I guess, first grade. I was about six, and my mother I have this one brother, the three of us went to Mexico for 9 months as the beginning of the breakup of the family, of my father, who wasn't very present before that. But at that point, we were in Mexico traveling. We were in a sort of camp or school, Peter and I were, for a short time. The rest of the time, we were with our mother, just traveling. So that also meant it took more effort on my part to keep up with the other students,
right,
through those years. And by the time I was in high school, I think I was equal to the other kids. But I was more interested in, well, when I applied to colleges from that year in Rome, my last year of high school in Rome,
uh-huh.
Yeah, I got into the Tyler School of Fine Arts in Philadelphia and then transferred to Cooper Union because it just seemed logical I would just move from the one to the other.
And then you eventually got your MFA from Yale, correct? And went on to teach?
Right.
Yeah. And I'm really curious because I read that you had what I think nowadays is sort of like, I don't know if it's the dream, but it's the stable best case scenario, I think, for a lot of artists who get their MFA, which is the tenured teaching position. And you walked away from that so that you could concentrate on your painting.
I did. I taught 2 years in Dayton, Ohio. Right out of graduate school. And then I got the Rome Prize Fellowship, which is also called the Prix de Rome. And it was 2 years for our group. For our group and the group sort of following us.
So you got to spend 2 years studying in Rome?
2 years self-studying. I mean, we had studios, amazing, wonderful studios in the American Academy, which was up on the Janicolo Hill, which is on the Vatican side of the river, of the Tiber River. So it's not downtown, and it's a hill, so that in the summer, in the hot months when the downtown is more congested with traffic, and if there's not a breeze, then the pollution sort of settles, and it can be very hot, you know, in a country with very little air conditioning.
And that was the experience that introduced you to life in Italy, correct? Or the idea, did that sort of plant the seed for you to move back later?
Well, my last year of high school, I was in Rome. Greece in the summer with my mother, and then Rome in a school that was taught in English. It was a very international student body. But I spent a lot of time wandering on my own in Rome. It's a beautiful city, just what any place in Italy has been.
Just to wander and look at.
Yeah, to walk into any church I passed.
Yes.
And see what's there. And, you know, if it was hot outside, it would be cool in church. And if it's raining outside, it would be dry in the church. If it's cold, it would be less cold. And there would be usually very dim light, like daylight coming through minimal sort of windows. A beautiful kind of space to be by yourself. And most of the churches, unlike the main ones, like the Vatican is over visited, the museum and the basilica, you know, the church itself. But when you pass little churches, and they're all over Italy, you know, anywhere, any town is going to have multiple churches, and Rome had them everywhere. So I could just walk into a church or walk down streets and find beautiful architecture, and architecture that's a mix between elements that were ancient Rome mixed with elements that were from all the centuries that followed, basically like up to maybe mid-19th century, and then maybe nothing that you could see from the outside that was more recent than 19th century, usually.
Wow.
And in the center anyway. And often there were fragments of sculpture and fragments of architecture or sarcophagi or something that would have Roman words or partial words, if it's a fragment, that were found. I would assume that a lot of those were found on the property of the house, like if there was a little garden space and people were digging, like let's say 200 years ago or 100 years ago, they would find a head or an arm of sculpture, and they would at some point, they started to embed those in the surface of the building, courtyards more than on the outside, on the street side. But you could walk into a courtyard and see a sarcophagus that's Roman, like a solid piece of marble carved with figures around it, the size of a bathtub, basically.
Wow.
To bury somebody in. But it's used as a fountain in a courtyard next to a couple of parked cars because the people who lived upstairs would park there, and there might be a statue, and there might be these things embedded in the walls. Rome, more than a lot of other parts of Italy, you can see the centuries from pre-Christian, you know, from before Christ, B.C., up to through the 19th century. And a little bit later, depends on what the building is. They're buildings that have elements of different centuries. And then there's sections like the Roman Forum that are the ruins only of the ancient.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit about your painting and how you have sort of incorporated your life in Italy. You made the decision to move to Assisi so that you could focus exclusively on your painting. Do I have that right?
I gave up that teaching, that tenure position at American University for a few reasons, but largely because I wanted to have more painting time and not to be teaching full time. And painting sales were good in that period. And I had a commission to do some paintings for a lobby in New York. They're no longer in the lobby, but they were for a few years. Because I had the commission to do, and we first thought we might move up to the coast of Maine, because it's interesting if, well, you did it when you went to Argentina. Most of us don't choose where we're going to live in our lives. When you're a child, you live where your parents live.
Yes.
And then maybe you go to a school, a boarding school, that's not where your parents live. And then you apply to college, and that may take you to another place because you take the best offer you get.
Yep.
For where you're accepted. And then if you can get teaching, which you started to mention in the beginning of this conversation, teaching, when I graduated from Yale with the MFA, it seemed to be the first year that a Yale graduate didn't almost automatically find a good teaching job. Before that, with a Yale degree, and there weren't so many people graduating with MFAs in those days.
No, it keeps
spreading. The numbers keep getting bigger and bigger.
It's ballooning.
So, well, I gave it up because I thought I could support a family on the sales of paintings, and we could move anywhere. We could live anywhere as long as we could get paintings back to our galleries. And Lonnie and I each had a gallery representing us at the time. And we just had to move paintings to the gallery, but we could live wherever we chose to.
Yes.
First time we had that freedom in our lives.
Yeah, and it's exciting, isn't it?
We always wanted to be near the sea and never had that chance for more than a summer or something. Then we thought, if we're going to be that isolated from New York, you know, it's going to be a big trip to get to the city where my gallery was, Forum Gallery. Then we could also be in Europe. I mean, why not? And our kids were little. When we moved, they were 5 years old and 8 years old when we left and went to Italy. And we thought that it would be wonderful to give them the opportunity to really know another culture, another language, another part of the world. When I was at the Academy in Rome, there was a painting in the large Museum of Contemporary Art in Rome. That's now it's in a smaller Museum of Contemporary Art and Modern Art in Rome. But at that time, it was in the larger one. It's by Felice Casorati, Casorati.
Okay.
And I didn't know his work before this. There's a whole group of painters who their best work was more or less between the wars, like in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, in that period, a lot of it around the 1920s.
Between World War I and World War II.
Right. Very strong period for figurative painting.
Yeah.
And sculpture. And this painting, this particular painting called Susanna, when I saw that, of all of his work, it's that one more than the others I really love. And that one painting has a male figure sitting on a chair, clothed, and a nude female figure on a chair, a separate chair. And there's, I think, a third chair. And there are papers on the floor, newspaper on the floor under them. And very little else. I mean, that's basically what the painting has. And in that period in Rome, my work started to know that I wanted to stay with figures. Yep. And within those 2 years, I decided I would stay with female figures until I had a reason to change that. But I did that for several years, mostly one or two or three female figures in an interior space made without models, just sometimes referring to paintings or photographs of sculpture.
And you usually use the mirror to...
I use mirrors a lot, yeah.
Could you describe that process?
Well, it's easy for heads. You know, doing self-portraits, a lot of us will talk about doing self-portraits. You always have the model ready and willing, right? You don't have to ask somebody or hire somebody.
Yes.
So as long as you want, and you can be alone in your studio. And all you need is a mirror. So it can also work for hands and arms and necks. And the hard part is when you get into a view that's not looking at a single mirror, but looking at, you know, between two mirrors to see a side view of your head, for example.
Right.
That gets tricky.
Do you literally have like several mirrors set up that you're moving around to get the... Okay.
Yeah, I do. I have... There's one that's mounted on a vertical thing that I can move around, like a lamp base, a floor lamp, sort of.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like that. A wooden thing with a heavy base. And that's only a small mirror, like the size of a computer, basically.
Uh-huh.
Like a laptop. And then another one that size that's attached to the wall, but on a hinge thing that I can arrange. I can move that to where I can see myself at whatever angle.
Uh-huh.
But I'm using myself, usually, if it's not a self-portrait, I'm using myself not too specifically. I mean, they're not all turning out like me, and I don't want that. But it's just that it helps to be looking at a model or yourself and to look through books. And almost every day I'm taking breaks and looking through books, and they vary. The ones closest, there's a bookcase right close to me when I'm painting. I can slide back, and then I'm right next to this bookcase and pull out one of any number of things. Some of them are catalogs of some contemporary people, Paul Fenniak, for example, really interesting painter. I like his work a lot. Or I'll look at Degas or Baltus or Pontormo, or, you know, a lot of people. Hans Holbein for heads. The drawings and the paintings.
Mm.
Portraits are just extraordinary for their clarity and the structure. And for thinking about composition, for example, I might be looking at Baltus or Casarati, who I mentioned. Just leafing through a book, stopping a certain page, thinking about the shapes outside of the figure, next to the figure, behind the figure.
When you're designing your composition, do you start with any of that in mind, or are you, you know, like some people kind of start with almost a picture in their head of what they want to create, and then other people start making marks and just keep adjusting until it pulls it out?
I'm more doing that than making marks and adjusting. I have a vague idea, depending on the shape and the size of the canvas, like thinking I'll put two figures seated, let's say, or one reclining, one sitting. And then I'll just start with the brush on the white prime canvas,
mm-hmm.
with pale color usually to begin, because I keep moving them.
Mm.
And I start moving the forms, moving the lines, moving. I'll have like two lines that are the arms, you know, the forearms. And I'll go from the one figure to the other, like the arm of one figure, the arm of the other figure, then the other arm of one figure, and the torso of one to the torso of the other, and then the legs, but shifting them around, changing them, the head, the neck, but also a little bit outside of the figure. So like a vertical from, it goes from the top down to the figure that's like a wall or doorway behind the figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe a table. And then that might move. And there was a painting a few years ago that had three figures, three women sitting. So from left to right, you know, it was just the three, one, two, three, with spaces between.
Mm-hmm.
And then the middle one, that was because she was farther back, which made her higher, a little smaller and a little higher. Mm-hmm. And the way she was coming so close to the top edge of the canvas, and the way in the lower part, the interaction between the forms of the three figures, I wasn't doing something that felt right. So I took out that third figure, the middle one, mm-hmm. and finished that painting without that. And I was showing slides to students here in Italy. There's an art school that I've heard mentioned in at least one of the other interviews in Monte Castello di Bibbia. I think it was Susan Walp. Mm-hmm. Who mentioned that she was there one summer, teaching in it, one part of one summer, some years ago. I was giving a slide talk there for students, and my older son, this was several years ago, was with us, and he said in the car on the way home, he said, what would you think about doing another version of that painting that you took the third figure out, but putting it back? And making it work and have, so you have two versions, because it really was rather nice in the period before I took that one out. Mm-hmm. So I did a second version of that painting. In the second one, I think they're three nudes. I'll often start them without clothing, and then early on, bits of clothing come in and then maybe go out again. I might take them out again.
So you're building the figure and then adding clothing afterwards
as I'm going. Yeah, uh-huh. I start without it usually, almost always.
Why is that?
If I might be doing, for example, a small canvas, let's say, 18 by 24 or something like that, then I might have a partial figure because I don't tend, on a small canvas, I don't tend to reduce the scale. So I'll have like a head and shoulders, maybe a hand, like looking at you right now on the computer screen, your hand and the way I see your hand and your face.
Uh-huh.
Like that would work very nicely. And then there's a little space around from the top of your head to the top of the canvas and from the side of your head to the left and right side of the canvas. In a case like that, I might then put in the clothing right from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Like a line, a curve of the collar of the shirt, for example, and then a color under that. There would be the neckline of a shirt.
Yeah.
The neckline of a shirt, then the neck and the head above that and the hair, maybe a sleeve below the hand. Well, I'm seeing right on.
You're painting, right, aren't
there.
You?
Yeah, I'm painting you. That's quite nice.
I can't wait to see it.
I'm tempted to take a picture of you there. But my way of working is just keep moving things.
Okay. And at that stage that you're talking about, are you still kind of sketching in with that light-colored pigment that you were talking about?
It starts that way. Mm-hmm. And then gradually it builds up. And I start working light and dark. You know, and modeling the volumes of the figure more and so on, or the shapes of clothing or drapery behind or something. But I also, in the first, depending on the size of the canvas and how the day goes, it might take 2 or 3 days to get paint on, to cover the white of the canvas.
Okay.
And then I feel like that when I don't have that white of the ground of the canvas, you know, that white can be a distraction until it's covered.
Yes.
You know, you don't see the whole painting as a painting quite as well until you cover that.
I'm glad you think the same way, because when there's white on the canvas, it's like a buzzing in my ear visually. Like I just can't stand it. I have to cover it up. Yeah.
Yeah, it does that. And the surface will get better as paint is added.
Uh-huh.
But I work with thin paint, you know, and I'm in the beginning, I'm using fairly worn out bristle brushes and I'm scrubbing it in, you know, the paint. Later, I'll use better brushes. And, you know, toward the end, I'm using brushes that are
more refined.
Yeah. A lot of them now are synthetic, like synthetic sable.
I'm so curious about your process and how you work. Just as an example, when you said, you know, oh, I'm tempted to take a picture of you right now because of the way that I was holding my hand, right? But yeah. Here's what I'm curious about. Not that you're going to paint me, but but I'm curious, like, if you were to do that and start your process, at what point do the mirrors come in? Like, would you then decide, like, oh, I would prefer to rotate, you know, like I have this picture that I'm using as reference and I'm going to adjust from that?
I think I very rarely, or maybe I don't at all, really work from a photograph. Mm-hmm. It's if I look at photographs, it's like the mirror. It's to help me, but not that I'm reproducing the photograph.
It's like a spark.
Yeah, it has something that I could begin with.
It seems like it might be almost like if you were a poet or a songwriter, when you might be out on the street and hear something or see something, and that comes into the poetry or the songwriting. It feels to me like photographs to you are more like just the briefest spark, and then you take that and do something completely different with it.
I suppose in terms of my paintings, it's like that. I like photographs. So I like, you know, I go to the monthly antique markets and street antique markets, antique and junk sort of markets in Italy. And when I made collages, which I did a lot of, I made a lot of collages in the period of graduate school and the couple of years after. Mm-hmm. And then I slowed down on those and was painting more hours painting. But the collages I make often have those old photographs in them, and I paint on top of those. When I paint over photographs, you see the photograph as well.
What are you working on now?
Well, for several years, I've been starting two paintings simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And then when I get to the point of feeling that something's working and I can, you know, I like what I'm seeing, then I would put one aside where I can see it, like on the floor leaning against that bookcase. And while I'm painting the one, and then when I finish with the one, more or less, I would switch and put the one that's like a third way along, you know, less than halfway done on the easel. But then the last few years, I've been painting the two, just switch painting a few days. In the beginning, one reason for changing from one to another in the beginning is that the paint is wet over the whole surface in a day, or it could be like the first and second day of painting, could be wet paint. So then to give that a few days to dry, I'd start the other. And then I could go back and forth. And then toward the end of a painting, I might have to spend the whole day painting a hand or a head.
Right.
Or a chair. Or a table. And then the next day I could paint another part of the same painting. So I could go for weeks painting, moving around the painting.
Bouncing between the three paintings that you have going.
Yeah. But I've been keeping for at least the last two pairs of paintings, I've been keeping the two going, alternating all the way from beginning to end. Maybe staying a week with one and then switching them, then like a week with the other and then switch it again. I've got three that I've done that with. Three pairs, and they're slow paintings. But with the last two pairs, I've had the same size, the two canvases, rectangles, but using one vertically and one horizontally in each case of the pair, which is kind of nice because then it's not going to be the same composition because one is horizontal and one's vertical.
Yeah. So when you're bouncing between those different paintings and you're pulling information back and forth between them, do you find that you're changing your motif or changing what you're, as you take something that you've learned from painting, you know, painting number one, for example, over to painting two, are you finding that it changes a lot? Because it sounds like you are very comfortable making big drastic changes within your painting if that's what the painting requires.
They're big and they're not, they're sometimes really big, like bringing a figure in that wasn't there or taking one out. Or there was one time when we were in Washington and I was painting larger then because the painting size we reduced, both of us reduced, because we have to get them back to New York, and we've been taking them with us on the airplane. So the larger ones come off the stretchers and they're rolled.
Uh-huh.
You know, sometimes I worry about whether they'll let me take a tube, but it's a fairly large tube, on the painting as cabin baggage.
Yes.
It has worked, but sometimes I've had to talk them into it, basically.
I've gone through that.
Yeah. And then I have stretchers made in Brooklyn that are then delivered to the framer where I stretch them.
You stretch it back yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. The framer sometimes helps me, works with me. He's a wonderful Spanish guy who's a very good framer, has a crew of people, but he sometimes will want to just work with me, stretching them just so that we're talking together.
I'm curious, from your perspective now, like, you've had a long career, and I'm sure you've seen so many changes over the last decade, I think, especially. There seems like there's been a lot of changes in the art world.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if you had advice for young artists who are starting out today, what would that be?
Yeah, I think, well, for one thing, I think it's a mistake to want to work in a particular style because they're successful people working that way. I think that's all wrong. I think it's going to fail anyway, because the people who make it big, let's say, you know, like the one who I just read somewhere that recently, that Jeff Koons earns more than any other artist today. You know, his income is enormous.
Mm.
Well, there's not going to be another person making Jeff Koons-like work who's going to get anywhere, because he's doing it.
Yes.
And if it's a certain kind of, I mean, there have often been two or three people fairly successful doing very similar work. But chances are, if you think of how many art students there are, if somebody, you know, if an art student says, well, I'm going to do white words, you know, a phrase on a green canvas, and I've forgotten the name of the artist who does that sort of thing. But, you know, you're not going to interest the dealer in showing your work just because somebody else who's doing that is very successful.
Right. They already have that person.
What you need to do, what the student needs to do, is find what is his or her own personal kind of work, way of seeing the world or way of understanding painting.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes time. Students are too impatient also. You know, students, when I finished school, none of us thought of getting a gallery and exhibiting right away. If it happened, it happened a little bit. Like you might be in a few group shows in the very beginning. But it takes time, and it shouldn't be rushed. If you can do some other kind of work to earn money, if you need to earn money to live on, and that frees you not to worry about selling your own work for a while, and just focus on what is most meaningful to you that has to do with who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have this experience. I know very little about you, but this experience in Argentina, living there, marrying an Argentine, that opens up another side of your life, which would possibly make your work unlike other people in California, painting in California.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how. I haven't looked at your work. Some people's work is very, very personal, like Frida Kahlo. Most students probably know Frida Kahlo.
Mm-hmm.
Because she's become fairly well known in the last, I don't know, 30 years or something.
Yeah, yeah. And she's almost an icon now.
Yeah. And I can't think of a more personal painter. You know, her paintings are about her tragic accident and the suffering she's had because of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of them they're about operations and body casts and dreams and fantasies that seem, most of them have this. I mean, some are just these beautiful self-portraits that don't show that. Yeah. But a lot of her work is very, very personal about her life and her life with Diego Rivera as well. You know, there's some double portrait, self-portrait with him that I can remember. And it's very Mexican in terms of Mexican art and folk art, I think.
Mm-hmm. It has that strong, strong influence.
And a sense of things. But if you think of all of the people in the museums, and, you know, aside from Shari's studio, the Metropolitan Museum was a place I spent a lot of time in. Museum of Modern Art, also because a friend would lend me his membership card to get in. But the Metropolitan used to be free, and it's now pay what you want.
Right.
Which a lot of people don't realize, but I pay 25 cents for two of us. And I think students and artists, I think, should not have to pay to go to a museum.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it should be our museum, you know.
Yeah.
We are making work for paintings or sculpture for the world, and the world should let us look at museums. So anyway, if you think of a museum, you think of any artist, we're talking about advice for students still, any artist, there's something about their work, almost all of them, that's different from other people who were their contemporaries. Like Rembrandt's paintings, portraits were different from Franz Hals. They hang near each other in the Met. I saw them just, you know, we were there just a few weeks ago for a month after 4 years of not being back in the States.
Oh, wow.
And I was looking at Rembrandt's and Franz Hals. There were differences. And at the same period that they were painting more or less in the same part of the world, there was Jan Steen and Franz Hals were painting these boisterous, turbulent images, you know, drunken people.
Yes, yeah.
Jan Steen especially, like dogs jumping up and...
Yeah, just these completely...
And then you think of Vermeer and Peter de Hoek and Metsu. There were several well-known, they're in books and museums, who painted these most serene, quiet paintings in the same period that the others were painting these boisterous paintings, drunken paintings.
Yeah.
And so there's a difference. Like for me, paintings I like are quiet paintings, and paintings I make are quiet paintings. And I know some contemporary painters who make noisy paintings, you know, the visually. I'm drawn to the quiet ones and the stillness and the quiet and a kind of order that's very controlled and very gentle in a way. And so that when I realized that those are the paintings I'm drawn to and the what comes out of me by itself, the kind of color I use too.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm not painting from observation where I'm saying, you know, that color, I don't have that color the same as I see it. It's, the, you know, the green is not as green or something.
Right,
you know, I'm going
right.
Gray in my color or something. You're learning about your own tendencies. And I think that's what the student should be trying to figure out. But it might start after school. It might start during school.
Yeah.
And it may start 2 years after school that you really say to yourself, well, this is, you know, this is wonderful. What I just did, I really love. Or I just saw a retrospective of so-and-so and I...
Really responding to that.
I've never realized how wonderful that is. And you start questioning why you're drawn to it. What's different about it?
Yes.
One thing I like to talk to students about is making things extraordinary, you know, more than ordinary. And you could think of it in terms of Morandi, who's been talked about in several of these interviews of yours.
Mm-hmm.
Morandi, who painted for years basically a collection of bottles and objects that he had in his studio. And some of them he painted, physically painted like a bottle. Or a,
right, that to make it that matte colored.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think he might have let dusted on things too, to gray them or soften them. But, you know, he could work. I think he was an honest, serious painter who had to do what he did. And it was not about supplying galleries with enough paintings that were like a Morandi. Right. I don't think he thought that way. I mean, I don't know much about it, but that's not the right approach. You know, to dealers should not expect that of an artist, that they produce, you know, 12 paintings that look like this, because there are some collectors out there asking.
Right, right.
You know, they should do what they have to do. The painter should do it, paint what they have to paint, the way they want to paint it.
Yes.
And I don't think it should change totally, unless it's a gradual change.
Yeah.
Someone like de Kooning moved from that early, beautiful, early figurative period gradually into abstraction. And then the woman won in 1950 or 51 or something. And then from that into those wilder women paintings that were abstract, fairly abstract.
Yeah.
But there were transitions that were logical. If you look at how he moved out of those early figures into those beginning of those, well, some of those figure things had elements that were like those non-figure abstract ones. And then they went into the abstract ones. There's one called Pink Angels.
Mm.
That's abstract, but you are almost looking at nude women in Pink Angels because of the pink, maybe, and this kind of shape of the hips and the back of a woman.
Interesting.
The transition is natural. And with Gorky, the transition was natural. There was an English painter named Malcolm Morley. I think he moved to the States. I don't know if he's still alive. A lot of painters who I think are the best ones, their transition, well, think also of Mondrian, who started out as a fairly traditional landscape painter and ended up with that stark, vertical, horizontal, flat color abstraction. But in between, there was a logical progression through the, like when he did the trees, maybe they were apple trees, and from those into those, just those vertical and horizontal marks within an oval or something that came out of the trees. But then I mentioned Malcolm Morley, who, when I was first aware of his work, when I was a student in the 60s, the art news in that period had a different format. It was a larger format than it became like other magazines. But it had, in each issue, it had so-and-so paints a painting, you know, and a double-page spread with, I guess, maybe a few, maybe four images of a painting in progress, different stages, and they discuss it. And he, in that period, he was painting photorealist paintings of ocean liners, like the Queen Mary, and a side view of the Queen Mary with all the little porthole windows. And
I'd forgotten about that. Wow, okay.
But then, so he was a very tight photorealist, doing what a lot of the photorealists did, which was to copy photographs so they looked like photographs, which was part of the point. Then he became an expressionist painter. And then he went back to a kind of something between the two. So there were, it didn't seem like one person could make that transition. It's like schizophrenia or being hit in the head, you know, falling off a horse and hitting your head, and then you don't know who you were.
Yeah.
And you do something totally different. But that's who he was. I mean, he did that.
Without a transition.
Yeah, without a transition. And maybe there was a transition that I didn't see. You know, I don't know this work that well.
Right.
Larry Rivers did something like that too. There was the period when I was, I think when I was a student in the 60s, when he was doing the big figure things with stenciled writing on the paintings, you know, kind of painterly figurative work with irony or humor mixed in. Like he had one of Napoleon, it might have been two Napoleons, with the hand in the, you know, the way Napoleon had his hand.
His tucks it into, yeah.
Yeah.
He's got the two fingers stuck it. Yeah.
Right. And it was called, I think that painting was called The World's Greatest Homosexual. I'm not sure. That's my memory was like that. So he was into a kind of pop, a version of pop art, I guess it was. You know, uh-huh. It wasn't Andy Warhol soup cans, but it was, you know, it had the stencil writing on it and stuff. And then I saw something of his that looked like large oil paintings that were very much like, or maybe actual copies of Japanese woodcut, like kabuki woodcuts from the 1800s or something.
Uh-huh.
Those two things, again, were like two different people. How can that same person, without falling off a horse and hitting his head, you know, why would he do that?
What do you think is the difference, though, between an artist exploring? I get this question a lot of, like, artists who haven't quite found what their voice is, for example, or they feel like they don't have a voice. And, you know, like my kind of take on that is it's kind of like your handwriting. You have it. You can't avoid it, yeah, in a sense. But when they're in that sort of exploratory stage, I think a lot of artists feel really confused at that point. Is, you know, am I being that artist that has fallen off the horse and can't make up their mind? Or am I in a search for something? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think you have to believe that you'll find yourself and give yourself the permission to experiment and fail, you know, in your own mind, fail. I mean, we have a kind of total freedom. We creative people, whether we're writers or visual artists, that's pretty wonderful. We can do what we want and we can want to enjoy it. One book that I had when I was around Shari, mm-hmm, by David Douglas Duncan, who was a photographer, and it was about Picasso. And my memory is that the photographer was fortunate to meet Picasso. Picasso was already very famous back then. And he wanted to meet Picasso, and he had been in Greece, I think, and had bought an ancient Greek coin that had an image. It might have been one of those images of an owl,
uh-huh,
or maybe of a head on the coin, like a silver coin. And I think he went to where Picasso lived in southern France, wherever it was, and maybe phoned him and said, you know, I'm who I am and a photographer, and I have this coin that makes me think of your work or something. Somehow Picasso was open to meeting this total stranger, no introduction, through a mutual friend.
Wow.
And they became really good friends. And this photographer did a lot of work photographing Picasso. But what stands out in my mind, black and white photographs, was he was photographing Picasso at home being playful, mostly at home being playful, with grandchildren, I think they must have been, and with himself and with his wife, and being silly, dancing in like shorts and his striped shirt or whatever it was.
Right.
And his work in that period, like the sculptures, like the goat, the baboon, you know, the sculpture he did of a baboon, the face of the baboon was a toy car, like a 1930s or 40s sedan. And he was playful. The Picasso Museum, when I was there years ago, some years ago, had the originals that the cast, the mold was made from. The originals had, like, I think they had that with the actual toy car that he built the baboon around. And mm-hmm. Some had, like, a straw basket that in the original was straw that's in the museum. And then the bronze casts of it. You know, those things and some of the collages and things he made, there's one I remember in the photographs in that book by David Douglas Duncan. He had for lunch, he had a fish, and he ate all the fish off the skeleton and then put the skeleton on a ceramic dish that he was making and made the skeleton part of the dish. he was playful like that. And there was something that I loved about how artists, what they had in their studios and what they made could be so playful.
I'm curious, like, do you think that that, do you feel like that has been lost? And if so, do you have any insight as to why that playfulness, you know, because I kind of feel that way, that artists are just so, can be so serious all the time, you know, that we've sort of lost that.
Well, there's so many of us. I'm sure there's some who haven't lost it. You want to recapture that, what we all had when we were children, the innocence and the freedom, mm-hmm. to try to recapture that, which is not so easy. It's a tricky thing because we're trained in a certain sense.
Yeah.
When I was a student, the teaching generally was minimal. If you had a good teacher, there were certain discussions or maybe a critique now and then that really was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the time they would make the rounds while the students were painting and say a few words to each one and so on. Now I think there are a lot of teachers who are more serious about making sure they impart knowledge that they have on the student for the student. It's just, it's opened up in a lot of ways. There's been the resurgence or beginnings, I guess it started a few decades ago, maybe, of conceptual art being taught and promoted.
Mm-hmm.
And my best understanding of that is that when art was not only art schools, like academies in Europe and schools with a primary teacher and maybe one or two assistants who had studios in Paris or in New York or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was art schools of different sizes. And then universities had started having art departments, but the thinking of the administration of a university is that the scholars should publish and the artists should exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
And also that the artists should be able to learn to write about their work. You know, that's sort of if you're going to get a university degree, the student shouldn't be illiterate and just say, you know, I make this stuff, you know,
right,
I don't
right.
know. I just like
exactly.
it. You know, they should be able to discuss it and to teach that way, you know, teach their students how to be able to formulate in pretty good language what they're doing. But then conceptual art became dependent on the backup of the explanation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you don't understand this work unless you read this, what the intention was behind it, and then, oh, okay, it's like that, you know. But for me, a visual artist, like visual art in the great museums in the world, it works visually. It's an international language, like music is an international language. You don't need to, you know, you can be Indian or French or German or Italian or American or Swedish and make a painting.
Yeah.
And you can, the same with music, you know, there can be slight differences.
And you can understand it.
And it's slightly different. Yeah, it doesn't require the spoken language and the written language. And that's the way I think it should be, that a painting or a sculpture should be complete in itself. I think I like to think for myself, for my paintings, that any painting I make should be able to stand on its own and have everything I want a painting to have in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And not just be one that you have to see a whole room full or a whole book full to say, oh, yeah, I can see what he's doing.
Mm.
But it should be like, if you find in a museum or if you find a reproduction or something of a painting by any number of people from the past, it can be an absolutely wonderful, complete image.
That's a great example. But then if you were able to see it, you know, within a body of work, you would get even more understanding of it, but you don't need that.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing to advise students. While you're a student, let's say 4 years or 6 years if you do graduate school. If you live near a city like Chicago or New York or Philadelphia or Boston or San Francisco, maybe Los Angeles, I don't know the West Coast very well, hardly. But if you live near museums, there are going to be, within your 4 or 6 years, there are going to be some retrospective shows that are major shows that happen for any particular artist. It may happen once in 20 years, unless they become very popular again, and then they may go out of fashion, you know, out of sight. Mm-hmm. But go and see those shows, even if it costs a little money to travel. Mm-hmm. But if you're flexible, like if it's Christmas vacation for a student or a midterm break, and you can leave any time within 2 weeks or something and go to another city for 2 days or 3 days.
Yeah.
Or if you have a friend you could stay with, longer is better. To try to see some of these retrospectives or these major shows that may not be a whole retrospective. Mm. It may be like Lonnie and I went to one years and years ago in New York, a Cezanne show that had the landscapes he did in the South. Mm. Like a wall of the same image, the same mountain, over and over, each one different, but always the same mountain.
You know? Right, right.
Or the same sort of ginger pot and apples or something in a still life a few times, or the three skulls that he did sometimes. Whoever it is, when we were in New York a few weeks ago, it was the end of a show by a painter we didn't know the work of. I'd only heard the name. Cary James Marshall.
Right. I didn't see that show, but I heard about it.
It was a beautiful show, mostly very large paintings, kind of like a big wall in your house, probably average room's wall. They were unstretched, like circus backdrop, sideshow backdrop paintings. They were canvas with grommets, you know, those metal circles. They didn't need frames. They were grommeted, screwed to the wall all the way around, so they're perfectly flat. And they were extraordinary paintings. You know, he's somebody painting kind of African-American culture, but a painter, or the museum also, because it is the Metropolitan Museum, they did something that may have started in London with the Tate or the National Gallery, probably the Tate Museum, that they ask an artist to select things from the collection, the permanent collection of the museum.
Oh, interesting.
That are meaningful to that artist. So it's like your questions to an artist, but the museum curator is saying, okay, why don't you find, you know, here are the books of the collection. So there may be things down in the racks in the basement.
Right, right.
Pick like 15 paintings or paintings and things, you know, maybe a ceramic thing that you really like for whatever reason.
Yes.
So there was one room like that that Marshall had, and then his big paintings. And it was a great show. It was very crowded because it was the last 3 days of the show or something when we got there. Mm. Maybe a Friday when they have later hours and we were there.
Yeah.
You know, it became dark while we were in there for the late hours, and lots of people. And interesting in that the people, the walls where the paintings were lit by the lighting for the paintings, the space between the walls in large spaces, the old Whitney Museum, was not lit. So people were silhouettes, almost like silhouettes in front of the paintings, which made them look like the figures in the paintings very much.
Oh, wow.
Except that they had legs that went down below the painting. And some of them were kind of extraordinarily dressed people, you know, I mean, they were going out to the museum together.
It was a night on the town.
And they were hairstyles that were like those in the painting, you know. But the paintings had, they had a playfulness. There's somebody who is playful in the work.
Yeah, yeah. Because he's heavily influenced by folk art and...
Yeah, folk art and people like Basquiat. Uh-huh. And I think Kitaj, R.B. Kitaj, K-I-T-A-J. I see a lot of connection between them. But then in the things that he selected from the collection, it was clear that he's very knowledgeable about the history of art.
Right.
And if you're knowledgeable, if you're a painter and you know paintings from past periods, you know, French paintings from the 19th century or Flemish or Italian paintings from centuries ago, your work is going to have some quality that's from that.
Yeah.
Something borrowed compositionally or about space, the treatment of space.
I'm curious, you once said something along the lines that you had said once that there, that you felt like there has been no progress in art in terms of, you know, those early cave paintings in France that are really, they're exquisitely drawn. They're not primordial or anything. And that you sort of made the case that the skill level has always been there, and that it's not that we're going to, as artists, progress in the terms of invent something new or make some new discovery, that those discoveries have been made.
Yeah.
And you mentioned also that the real, I guess, discoveries is making your art personal. And I was wondering, could you, I mean, given what we were just, what we're just talking about and the playfulness and also that idea of painting the same subject matter over and over again, I'm curious what your thoughts are on that and how you see these paintings in the Cezanne exhibit where he's painting, you know, a similar subject over and over.
I think a painter needs to work a series, spend a year or two or three or 10 or whatever years painting fairly similar things because they get better. Usually they'll get better.
Mm-hmm. If you're asking the right questions, I suppose.
We will understand what we're doing better. And in that space of months or years, we're looking at things differently in museums and galleries or books. You know, if you live in, let's say, in Vermont, and what you're looking at might be your own book collection with an occasional trip to Boston or New York or something. I don't know what's up there, but if you're in an outlying area, you can have books. And books are being made more easily with the kinds of digital photography and different advances in printing, that they can cost less and we can have them, you know, they range a lot, but you can have pretty good books for very little. And you can find them used on Amazon with the secondary dealers, AB books and those things. If you know what you're looking for, you know, if you've seen a book you really want, or you've seen an artist you're really interested in, the internet is pretty good now for finding, like, these Italians between the wars. If you know the names, you can find these things, like Casarati. You can find this painting that I mentioned, Susanna. Or there's a Dutch painter named Dick Ket, K-E-T is the last name, who painted during the war, I think, in the 40s. He was very sick, physically ill, and you see it in the paintings. The way, in a different way, but almost like Frida Kahlo, you see, because he did self-portraits and he did still lives, and both are extraordinary paintings. Write that name down, Dick Ket, K-E-T.
K-E-T, okay, I put down
Dutch.
K-E-T.
Because if you Google these people and then hit images, you'll find them.
Mm-hmm.
The self-portraits, vertical canvases, and then the still lives, very wonderful paintings. But you can see, well, when we were a few years ago, we were with Israel Hirschberg. He's been mentioned on your things.
Yes.
Because he teaches in Italy every summer now.
Yeah.
But we mentioned Dick Ket to him, and he was looking at one when we were talking, and he said, those are clubbed fingers, clubbed. The ends of Dick Ket's fingers, the last part of the finger is enlarged over the rest of the hand. And that's the sign of a particular illness that Israel was aware of. This illness has that symptom. But you see in some of them, he's sweating. There's one, there are three small heads that are, I guess they're like three that go together, like it's supposed to be hung together. They're reproduced together. And in one, there's like a bowl of medicine, and one, he's got a like a white cloth over his top of his head. And I think I think he's painting himself with his illness. He probably died young. I think he did. But at the same time, his illness may have saved him from dying in the war, because I think it was that period that he was working. Some good artists died in the war, both wars, big wars.
Yeah. I looked him up, and it looks like he died at 38. He was 1902 to 1940, so very young.
Yeah, that's too young.
Yeah.
It's tragic. When somebody's that good, it's more tragic than normal.
Yes. Alan, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I really appreciate it. This has been just a phenomenal conversation. I love listening to you talk about your life and your work.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I've enjoyed this. I was a little worried about it before it started.
Uh-oh.
You're very good with us, with the shy painters. You know how to deal with us.
Probably because I'm one of you, I know. What an honor that was. My gratitude to Alan Feltes for taking the time to talk with me and for sharing his insights with us. Go to savvypainter.com for show notes on this episode and to see Ellen's paintings. They are wonderful. Do not miss them. And while you're there, make sure you don't miss an episode of the podcast. Sign up for show updates and free guides at savvypainter.com/subscribe, or just look for the yellow button in the sidebar. One more thing I want to let you know. This year, you can expect a lot more workshops from Savvy Painter. If you are an artist who struggles with getting painting time in, or feels like you're always busy but never really moving forward with your art, then my workshops just might interest you. Past workshops include Mindset Mastery, a 5-week online workshop to help you get past the roadblocks that keep you from painting. In it, we tackle the inner critic, fears of artists, and setting yourself up for a successful creative day. The workshop, How to Develop a Relationship with the Right Gallery, helped several artists find the right gallery and show their work. So if this is something that interests you, you can go to savvypainter.com/workshop and get on the email list. This is separate from the main list that tells you when a new episode comes out. This is just for the workshop, so you don't get quite as many emails, but when you do, there's always something really good happening. Sign up now and get a downloadable PDF with case studies that tell you exactly how 3 artists pushed through barriers that were getting in the way of their studio time. You can, for example, learn how Rhonda went from not wanting to call herself an artist to getting her very first solo show. Also, listen to an introverted artist describe how she built her confidence and then spoke in front of an audience of her peers. And you can discover the tools that Samantha used to take back her power after a decade of believing that she had no, I'm putting air quotes there, she had no talent. So again, go to savvypainter.com/workshop to reserve your place on the list. When you sign up, you get that downloadable case studies that I mentioned, but more importantly, you get exclusive invites to upcoming workshops. Most of the time when I launch a new program, it sells out before I ever announce it publicly. So reserve your spot now at savvypainter.com/workshop. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.